motion she'd seen in any lifeless, though she might have imagined it. Determination. The three attacked. She had assumed, in her ignorance back in Idris, that lifeless were like decaying skeletons or corpses. She'd imagined them attacking in waves, lacking skill, but having relentless, dark power. She'd been wrong. These creatures moved with proficiency and coordination, just as a human might. Except there was no speaking, no yelling or grunting, just silence, as Claude fended off one attack, then rammed his elbow into the face of a second lifeless. He moved with a fluidity she had rarely seen, his skill matching the brief moment of dazzling speed that Denth had displayed in the restaurant. Claude whipped his sword around and took the third lifeless in the leg. One of the others, however, rammed his blade through Claude's stomach. Something clear squirted out both sides, spraying Vivenna. Claude didn't even grunt as he brought his weapon around and took off a second head. The lifeless guard died, falling to the ground and leaving his weapon sticking from Claude's stomach. One of the other guards stumbled away, leg bleeding clear blood, and then it fell backward to the ground too. Claude efficiently turned his attention to the last standing lifeless, which didn't retreat, but took an obviously defensive stance. The stance didn't work. Claude took this last one down in a matter of seconds, slamming his sword repeatedly against that of his opponent, before spinning it around in an unexpected motion and taking off his enemy's sword hand. That was followed by a blow to the stomach, dropping the creature. In a final motion, he efficiently rammed his blade through the neck of a fallen creature, stopping it from trying to crawl toward Vivenna, a knife in its hand. The alleyway fell still. Claude turned toward her, eyes lacking emotion, square jaw and rectangular face set above a thick, muscled neck. He began to twitch. He shook his head, as if trying to clear his vision. An awful lot of clear liquid was pouring from his torso. He placed one hand against the wall, then slumped to his knees. Vivenna hesitated, then reached out a hand toward him. Her hand fell on his arm. The skin was cold. A shadow moved on the other side of the alleyway. She looked up, apprehensive, still in shock.
"Oh, colors,"
Tonk Fa said, running forward, outfit wet with clear liquid.
"Denth, she's here."
He knelt down beside Vivenna.
"You okay?"
She nodded dully, only barely aware that she was still holding her skirt in one hand. That meant her legs, to just above her knees, were exposed. She couldn't find it in herself to care, nor did she care that her hair was bleached white. She just stared at Claude, who knelt before her, head bowed, as if worshipping at some strange altar. His weapon slipped from his twitching fingers and clanged to the cobbles. His eyes stared forward, glassy. Tonk Fa followed her gaze, looking at Claude.
"Yeah," he said. "Jules is not going to be pleased. Come on, we need to get out of here."
Chapter 32. He was always gone when Ciri awoke. She lay in the deep, well-stuffed bed, morning light streaming through the window. Already, the day was growing warm, and even her single sheet was too hot. She threw it off, but remained on the bed, looking up at the ceiling. She could tell from the sunlight that it was nearly noon. She and Sesebron tended to stay up late, talking. That was probably a good thing. Some might see that she was getting up later and later each morning, and think that it was due to other activities. She stretched. At first, it had been strange to communicate with the God King. As the days progressed, however, it was feeling more and more natural to her. She found his writing, uncertain, unpracticed letters that explained such interesting thoughts, to be endearing. If he spoke, she suspected that his voice would be kindly. He was so tender. She'd never have expected that. She smiled, sinking back into her pillow, idly wishing for him to still be there when she awoke. She was happy. That also was something she'd never expected from Hallandrin. She did miss the Highlands, and her inability to leave the Court of Gods frustrated her, particularly considering the politics. And yet there were other things, marvelous things, the brilliant colors, the performers, the sheer overwhelming experience of Teteller. And there was the opportunity to speak with Sisebron each night. Her brashness had been such a shame and an embarrassment to her family, but Sisebron found it fascinating, even alluring. She smiled again, letting herself dream. However, real life began to intrude. Sisebron was in danger. Real, serious danger. He refused to believe that his priests could bear him any sort of malice or be a threat. That same innocence which made him so appealing was also a terrible liability. But what to do? Nobody else knew of his predicament. There was only one person who could help him. That person, unfortunately, wasn't up to the task. She had ignored her lessons and had come to her fate wholly unprepared. So what? A part of her mind whispered. Ciri stared at the ceiling. She found it hard to summon her customary shame at having ignored her lessons. She'd made a mistake. How much time was she going to spend moping, annoyed at herself for something done and gone? All right, she told herself. Enough excuses. I might not have prepared as well as I should, but I'm here now, and I need to do something. Because nobody else will. She climbed out of bed, running her fingers through her long hair. Sisebron liked it long. He found it as fascinating as her serving women did. With them to help her care for it, the length was worth the trouble. She folded her arms, wearing only her shift, pacing. She needed to play their game. She hated thinking of it that way. Game implied small stakes. This was no game. It was the God King's life. She searched through her memory, dredging up what scraps she could from her lessons. Politics was about exchanges. It was about giving what you had, or what you implied that you had, in order to gain more. It was like being a merchant. You started with a certain stock, and by the end of the year, you hoped to have increased that stock, or maybe even have changed it into a completely different and better stock. Don't make too many waves until you're ready to strike, Lightsong had told her. Don't appear too innocent, but don't appear too smart either. Be average. She stopped beside the bed, then gathered up the bedsheets and towed them over to the smoldering fire to burn, as was her daily chore. Exchanges, she thought, watching the sheets catch fire in the large hearth. What do I have to trade or exchange? Not much. It would have to do. She walked over and pulled open the door. As usual, a group of serving women waited outside. Ciri's standard ladies moved around her, bringing clothing. Another group of servants, however, moved to tidy the room. Several of these wore brown. As her servants dressed her, she watched one of the girls in brown. At a convenient moment, Ciri stepped over, putting a hand on the girl's shoulder. "You're from Pankal?" Ciri said quietly. The girl nodded, surprised.
"I have a message I want you to give to Blue Fingers,"
Ciri whispered.
"Tell him I have vital information he needs to know. I'd like to trade. Tell him it could change his plans drastically."
The girl paled, but nodded, and Ciri stepped back to continue dressing. Several of the other serving women had heard the exchange, but it was a sacred tenet of the Hallandrin religion that the servants of a god weren't to repeat what they heard in confidence. Hopefully that would hold true. If it didn't, then she hadn't really given that much away. Now she just had to decide just what vital information she had, and why exactly Bluefingers should care about it.
"My dear queen," Lightsong said, actually going so far as to embrace Ciri as she stepped into his box at the arena. Ciri smiled as Lightsong waved for her to seat herself in one of his chaise lounges. Ciri sat with care. She was coming to favor the elaborate Halandrin gowns, but moving gracefully in them took quite a bit of skill. As she settled, Lightsong called for fruit.
"You treat me too kindly," Ciri said.
"Nonsense," Lightsong said. "You're my queen. Besides, you remind me of someone of whom I was very fond."
"And who is that?"
"I honestly have no idea," Lightsong said, accepting a plate of sliced grapes, then handing them to Ciri. "I can barely remember her." "Grapes?"
Ciri raised an eyebrow, but she knew by now not to encourage him too much.
"Tell me," she asked, using a little wooden spear to eat her grape slices. "Why do they call you Lightsong the Bold?"
"There is an easy answer to that," he said, leaning back. "It's because of all the gods, only I am bold enough to act like a complete idiot."
Ciri raised an eyebrow.
"My station requires true courage," he continued. "You see, I am normally quite a solemn and boring person. At nights, my fondest desire is to sit and compose interminably periphrastic lectures on morality for my priests to read to my followers. Alas, I cannot. Instead, I go out each evening, abandoning didactic theology in favor of something which requires true courage, spending time with the other gods."
"Why does that take courage?"
He looked at her. "My lady, have you seen how positively tedious they all can be?"
Ciri laughed.
"Oh, really?" she said. "Where did the name come from?"
"It's a complete misnomer," Lightsong said. "Obviously you're intelligent enough to see that. Our names and titles are assigned randomly by a small monkey who has been fed an exceedingly large amount of gin."
"Now you're just being silly."
"Now?" Lightsong asked. "Now?" He raised a cup of wine toward her. "My dear, I am always silly. Please be good enough to retract that statement at once."
Ciri just shook her head. Lightsong, it appeared, was in rare form this afternoon.
"Great," she thought. "My husband is in danger of being murdered by unknown forces, and my only allies are a scribe who's afraid of me and a god who makes no sense."
"It has to do with death," Lightsong finally said, as the priests began to file into the arena floor below for this day's round of arguments.
Ciri looked toward him.
"All men die," Lightsong said. "Some, however, die in ways that exemplify a particular attribute or emotion. They show a spark of something greater than the rest of mankind. That is what is said to bring us back."
He fell silent.
"You died showing great bravery, then?"
Ciri asked.
"Apparently," he said. "I don't know for sure. Something in my dream suggests that I may have insulted a very large panther. That sounds rather brave, don't you think?"
"You don't know how you died?"
He shook his head.
"We forget," he said. "We awake without memories. I don't even know what work I did."
Ciri smiled. "I suspect that you were a diplomat or a salesman of some sort, something that required you to talk a lot, but say very little."
"Yes," he said quietly, seeming unlike himself as he stared down at the priests below.
"Yes, no doubt that was it exactly."
He shook his head, then smiled at her.
"Regardless, my dear queen, I have provided a surprise for you this day."
"Do I want to be surprised by Lightsong?"
She glanced about nervously. He laughed.
"No need to fear," he said. "My surprises rarely cause bodily harm, and never to beautiful queens."
He waved his hand, and an elderly man with an extraordinarily long white beard approached. Ciri frowned.
"This is Hoid," Lightsong said, "master storyteller. I believe you had some questions you wished to ask."
Ciri laughed in relief, remembering only now her request to Lightsong. She glanced at the priests below.
Shouldn't we be paying attention to the speeches?"
Lightsong waved indifferently. "Pay attention? Ridiculous. That would be far too responsible of us. We're gods, for the color's sake. Or, well, I am. You're close enough. A god in law, one might say. Anyway, do you really want to listen to a bunch of stuffy priests talk about sewage treatment?"
Ciri grimaced. "I thought not.
Besides, neither of us has votes pertaining to this issue, so let us spend our time wisely. We never know when we will run out."
"Of time?" Ciri asked. "But you're immortal."
"Not run out of time," Lightsong said, holding up his plate. "Of grapes. I hate listening to storytellers without grapes."
Ciri rolled her eyes, but continued to eat the grape slices. The storyteller waited patiently. As she looked more closely, she could tell that he wasn't quite as old as he seemed at first glance. The beard must be a badge of his profession, and while it didn't appear to be fake, she suspected that it had been bleached. He was really much younger than he wanted to appear. Still, she doubted Lightsong would have settled for anyone other than the very best. She settled back in her chair, which, she noticed, had been crafted for someone of her size.
"I should be careful with my questions," she thought. "I can't ask directly about the deaths of the old god kings. That would be too obvious."
"Storyteller," she said, "what do you know of Halandrin history?"
"Much, my queen,"
he said, bowing his head.
"Tell me of the days before the division between Idris and Halandrin."
"Ah," the man said, reaching into a pocket.
He pulled out a handful of sand and began to rub it between his fingers, letting it drop in a soft stream toward the ground, its grains blown slightly in the wind.
"Her Majesty wishes one of the deep stories from long before, a story before time began?"
"I wish to know the origins of the Halandrin god kings."
"Then we begin in the distant haze," the storyteller said,
bringing up another hand, letting powdery black sand drop from it, mixing with the sand that fell from the first hand. As Ciri watched, the black sand turned white, and she cocked her head, smiling at the display.
"The first god king of Halandrin is ancient," Hoid said. "Ancient, yes. Older than kingdoms and cities. Older than monarchs and religions. Not older than the mountains, for they were already here. Like the knuckles of the sleeping giants below, they formed this valley, where panthers and flowers both make their home." "We speak of just the valley, then, a place before it had a name. The people of Chedesh still dominated the world. They sailed the inner sea, coming from the east, and it was they who first discovered this strange land. Their writings are sparse. Their empire has long since been taken by the dust, but memory remains. Perhaps you can imagine their surprise upon arriving here, a place with beaches of fine soft sand, with fruits aplenty, and with strange alien forests."
Hoid reached into his robes and pulled out a handful of something else. He began to drop it before him, small green leaves from the fronds of a fern.
"Paradise, they called it," Hoid whispered. "A paradise hidden between the mountains, a land with pleasant rains that never grew cold, a land where succulent food grew spontaneously."
He threw the handful of leaves into the air, and in the center of them puffed a burst of colorful dust, like a tiny flameless firework.
deep reds and blues mixed in the air, blowing around him.
"A land of color," he said. "Because of the tears of Edgeley, the striking flowers of such brilliance that could yield dyes that would hold fast in any cloth."
Ciri had never really thought about how Halandrin would look to people who came across the Inner Sea. She'd heard stories from the Ramblemen who came into Idris, and they spoke of distant places. In other lands, one found prairies and steppes, mountains and deserts, but not jungles. Halandrin was unique.
"The first returned was born during this time," Hoyd said, sprinkling a handful of silver glitter into the air before him. "Aboard a ship that was sailing the coast, returned can now be found in all parts of the world. But the first one, the man whom you call Vo, but we name only by his title, was born here, in the waters of this very bay. He declared the five visions. He died a week later. The men of his ship founded a kingdom upon these beaches, then called Hanald. Before their arrival, all that had existed in these jungles was the people of Pankal, more a mere collection of fishing villages than a true kingdom."
The glitter ran out, and Hoyd began to drop a powdery brown dirt from his other hand as he reached into another pocket.
"Now, you may wonder why I must travel back so far. Should I not speak of the Many War, of the shattering of kingdoms, of the five scholars, of Kalad, the usurper, and his phantom army, which some say still hides in these jungles, waiting? Those are the events we focus upon, the ones men know the best. To speak only of them, however, is to ignore the history of 300 years that led up to them. Would there have been a Many War without knowledge of the returned? It was a returned, after all, who predicted the war and prompted Strife Lover to attack the kingdoms across the mountains."
"Strife Lover?" Ciri interrupted.
"Yes, Your Majesty,"
Hoyd said, switching to a black dust.
"Strife Lover. Another name for Kalad the usurper."
"That sounds like the name of a returned." Hoyd nodded.
"Indeed," he said. "Kalad was returned, as was Peacegiver, the man who overthrew him and founded Halandrin. We haven't arrived at that part yet. We are still back in Hanald, the outpost become kingdom, founded by the men of the first return's crew. They were the ones who chose the first return's wife as their queen, then used the tears of Edgeley to create fantastic dyes which sold for untold riches across the world. This soon became a bustling center of trade."
He removed a handful of flower petals and began to let them fall before him.
"The tears of Edgeley, the source of Halandrin wealth. Such small things, so easy to grow here. And yet, this is the only soil where they will live. In other parts of the world, dyes are very difficult to produce. Expensive. Some scholars say that the Many War was fought over these flower petals. That the kingdoms of Cuth and Huth were destroyed by little drips of color."
The petals fell to the floor.
"But only some of the scholars say that, storyteller," Lightsong said. Ciri turned, having almost forgotten that he was with her. "What do the rest say? Why was the Many War fought in their opinions?"
The storyteller fell silent for a moment, and then he pulled out two handfuls and began to release dust of a half dozen different colors.
"Breath, Your Grace. Most agree that the Many War was not only about petals squeezed dry, but a much greater prize. People squeezed dry. You know, perhaps, that the royal family was growing increasingly interested in the process by which breath could be used to bring objects to life. Awakening, it was then first being called. It was a fresh and poorly understood art then,
It still is, in many ways. The workings of the souls of men, their power to animate ordinary objects and the dead to life, is something discovered barely 4 centuries ago, a short time by the accounting of gods.
Unlike a court proceeding, Lightsong mumbled, glancing over at the priests who were still talking about sanitation, those seem to last an eternity, according to the accounting of this god.
The storyteller didn't break stride at the interruption. Breath, he said. The years leading up to the Many War, those were the days of the 5 scholars and the discovery of new commands. To some, this was a time of great enlightenment and learning. Others call them the darkest days of men, for it was then we learned to best exploit one another. He began to drop 2 handfuls of dust, one bright yellow, the other black. Ciri watched, amused. He seemed to be slanting what he said toward her, careful not to offend her Idrian sensibilities. What did she really know of breath? She'd rarely even seen any awakeners in the court. Even when she did, she didn't really care. The monks had spoken against such things, but, well, she had paid about as much attention to them as she had to her tutors. One of the 5 scholars made a discovery. Hoyt continued, dropping a handful of white scraps, small torn pieces of paper with writing on them. Commands, methods, the means by which a lifeless could be created from a single breath. This, perhaps, seems a small thing to you, but you must look at the past of this kingdom and its founding. Helendrin began with the servants of a returned and was developed by an expansive mercantile effort. It controlled a uniquely lucrative region, which, through the discovery and maintenance of the northern passes, combined with increasingly skillful navigation, was becoming a jewel coveted by the rest of the world. He paused, and his second hand came up, dropping little bits of metal, which fell to the stonework with a sound not unlike falling rain. "And so the war came," he said. "The 5 scholars split, joining different sides. Some kingdoms gained the use of lifeless, while others did not. Some kingdoms had weapons, others could only envy." To answer the god's question, my story claims one other reason for the Many War, the ability to create lifeless so cheaply. Before the discovery of the single breath command, lifeless took 50 breaths to make. Extra soldiers, even a lifeless one, are of limited use if you can gain only 1 for every 50 men you already have. However, being able to create a lifeless with a single breath, 1 for 1, that will double your troops, and half of them won't need to eat. The metal stopped falling. "Lifeless are no stronger than living men," Hoyt said. "They are the same. They are not more skilled than living men. They are the same. However, not having to eat like regular men, that advantage was enormous. Mix that with their ability to ignore pain and never feel fear, and suddenly you had an army that others couldn't stand against. It was taken even further by Kalad, who was said to have created a new and more powerful type of lifeless, gaining an advantage even more frightening."
"What kind of new lifeless?" Ciri asked, curious.
"Nobody remembers, Your Majesty," Hoyt explained. "The records of that time have been lost. Some say they were burned intentionally. Whatever the true nature of Kalad's phantoms, they were frightening and terrible. So much so that even though the details have been lost in time, the phantoms themselves live on in our lore and our curses."
"Do they really still exist out there?" Ciri asked, shivering slightly, glancing toward the unseen jungles. "Like the stories say? An unseen army waiting for Kalad to return and command them again?"
"Alas," Hoyt said, "I can tell only stories. As I said, so much from that time is lost to us now." But we know of the royal family, Ciri said. They broke away because they didn't agree with what Kalad was doing, right? They saw moral problems with using lifeless.
The storyteller hesitated.
Why, yes, he finally said, smiling through his beard. Yes, they did, Your Majesty.
She raised an eyebrow.
Psst, Lightsong said, leaning in. He's lying to you.
Your Grace, the storyteller said, bowing deeply, I beg your pardon. There are diverging explanations. Why, I am a teller of stories, all stories.
And what do other stories say? Ciri asked.
None of them agree, Your Majesty,
Hoyd said.
Your people speak of religious indignation and of treachery by Kalad the Usurper. The Pankal people tell of the royal family working hard to gain powerful lifeless and awakeners, then being surprised when their tools turned against them. In Halandrin, they tell of the royal family aligning themselves with Kalad, making him their general and ignoring the will of the people by seeking war with bloodlust.
He looked up and then began to trail two handfuls of black burned charcoal.
But time burns away behind us, leaving only ash and memory. That memory passes from mind to mind, then finally to my lips. When all is truth and all are lies, does it matter if some say the royal family sought to create lifeless? Your belief is your own.
Either way, the returned took control of Halandrin, she said.
Yes, Hoyt said, and they gave it a new name, a variation on the old one, and yet some still speak regretfully of the royals who left, bearing the blood of the first returned to their highlands.
Ciri frowned. Blood of the first returned?
Yes, of course, Hoyd said. It was his wife, pregnant with his child, who became the first queen of this land. You are his descendant.
She sat back. Lightsong turned, curious. You didn't know this? He asked, in a tone lacking his normal flippancy. She shook her head. If this fact is known to my people, we don't speak of it. Lightsong seemed to find that interesting. Down below, the priests were moving on to a different topic, something about security in the city and increasing patrols in the slums. She smiled, sensing a subtle way to get to the questions she really wanted to ask.
That means that the God Kings of Halandrin carried on without the blood of the first returned.
Yes, Your Majesty,
Hoyd said, crumbling clay out into the air before him. And how many God Kings have there been?
5, Your Majesty, the man said, including His Immortal Majesty, Lord Sosebron, but not including Peacegiver.
5 kings, she said. In 300 years?
Yes, Your Majesty,
Hoyd said, bringing out a handful of golden dust, letting it fall before him.
The dynasty of Halandrin was founded at the conclusion of the Many War, the first one gaining his breath and life from Peacegiver himself, who was revered for dispelling Kalad's phantoms and bringing a peaceful end to the Many War. Since that day, each God King has fathered a stillborn son, who then returned and took his place.
Ciri leaned forward. Wait, how did Peacegiver create a new God King?
Ah, Hoyd said, switching back to sand with his left hand. Now there is a story lost in time. How indeed? Breath can be passed from one man to another, but breath, no matter how much, doesn't make one a god. Legends say that Peacegiver died by granting his breath to his successor. After all, can a god not give his life away to bless another?
Not exactly a sign of mental stability, in my opinion, Lightsong said, waving for some more grapes. You don't encourage confidence in our predecessors, storyteller. Besides, even if a god gives away his breath, it doesn't make the recipient divine.
I only tell stories, Your Grace, Hoyd repeated. They may be truths, they may be fictions. All I know is that the stories themselves exist, and that I must tell them.
With as much flair as possible, Ciri thought, watching him reach into yet another pocket and pull free a handful of small bits of grass and earth. He let bits fall slowly between his fingers.
I speak of foundations, Your Grace, Hoyd said. Peacegiver was no ordinary returned, for he managed to stop the lifeless from rampaging. Indeed, he sent away Kalad's phantoms, which formed the main bulk of the Halandrin army. By doing so, he left his own people powerless. He did so in an effort to bring peace. By then, of course, it was too late for Cuth and Huth. However, the other kingdoms, Khan-Kahl, Tedradel, Gis, and Halandrin itself, were brought out of the conflict. Can we not assume more from this god of gods who was able to accomplish so much? Perhaps he did do something unique, as the priests claim, leave some seed within the god-kings of Halandrin, allowing them to pass their power and divinity from father to son. Heritage which would give them a real claim to rule, Ciri thought, idly slipping a sliced grape into her mouth. With such an amazing god as their progenitor, they could become god-kings, and the only one who could threaten them would be the royal family of Idris, who can apparently trace their line back to the first returned. Another heritage of divinity, a challenger for rightful rule in Halandrin. That didn't tell her how the god kings had died, nor did it tell her why some gods, such as the first returned, could bear children, while others could not. They're immortal, correct? Ciri asked. Hoyd nodded, smoothly dropping the rest of his grass and dirt, moving into a different discussion by bringing forth a handful of white powder. Indeed, Your Majesty, like all returned, the god-kings do not age. Agelessness is a gift for all who reach the fifth heightening. But why have there been five god-kings? She asked. Why did the first one die? Why do any return pass on, Your Majesty? Hoyd asked. Because they're loony,
Lightsong said.
The storyteller smiled. Because they tire. Gods are not like ordinary men. They come back for us, not for themselves. And when they can no longer endure life, they pass on. God kings live only as long as it takes them to produce an heir.
Ciri started. That's commonly known? She asked, then cringed slightly at the potentially suspicious comment.
Of course it is, Your Majesty, the storyteller said. At least, to storytellers and scholars. Each god king has passed from this world shortly after his son and heir was born. It is natural. Once the heir has arrived, the god king grows restless. Each one has sought out an opportunity to use up his breath to benefit the realm. And then?
He threw up a hand, snapping his fingers, throwing up a little spray of water, which puffed to mist.
And then they pass on, he said, leaving their people blessed and their heir to rule.
The group fell silent, the mist evaporating in front of Hoyd. Not exactly the most pleasant thing to inform a newly wed wife, storyteller, Lightsong noted,
that her husband is going to grow bored with life as soon as she bears him a son. I seek not to be charming, Your Grace, Hoyd said, bowing.
At his feet, the various dusts, sands, and glitters mixed together in the faint breeze.
I only tell stories. This one is known to most. I should think that Her Majesty would like to be aware of it as well.
Thank you, Ciri said quietly. It was good of you to speak of it. Tell me, where did you learn such an unusual method of storytelling?
Hoyd looked up, smiling. I learned it many, many years ago, from a man who didn't know who he was, Your Majesty. It was a distant place where two lands meet and gods have died, but that is unimportant.
Ciri ascribed the vague explanation to Hoyd's desire to create a suitably romantic and mysterious past for himself. Of far more interest to her was what he'd said about the God King's deaths.
So there is an official explanation, she thought, stomach twisting, and it's actually a pretty good one. Theologically, it makes sense that the God Kings would depart once they had arranged for a suitable successor. But that doesn't explain how Peacegiver's treasure, that wealth of breath, passes from God King to God King when they have no tongues. And it doesn't explain why a man like Sisebron would get tired of life when he seems so excited by it.
The official story would work fine for those who didn't know the God King. It fell flat for Ciri. Sisebron would never do such a thing. Not now.
Yet, would things change if she bore him a son? Would Sisebron grow tired of her that easily?
Maybe we should be hoping for old Sisebron to pass, my queen, Lightsong said idly, picking at the grapes. You were forced into all this, I suspect. If Sisebron died, you might even be able to go home. No harm done, people healed, new heir on the throne, everyone is either happy or dead.
The priests continued to argue below. Hoyd bowed, waiting for dismissal.
Happy or dead?
Her stomach twisted. Excuse me, she said, rising. I would like to walk about a bit. Thank you for your storytelling, Hoyd.
With that, entourage in tow, she quickly left the pavilion, preferring that Lightsong not see her tears.
Chapter 33. Jules worked quietly, ignoring Vivenna and pulling another stitch tight. Claude's guts, intestines, stomach, and some other things Vivenna didn't want to identify, lay on the floor beside him, carefully pulled out and arranged so that they could be repaired. Jules was working on the intestines at the moment, sewing with a special thick thread and curved needle. It was gruesome. And yet, it didn't really affect Vivenna, not after the shock she'd had earlier. They were in the safe house. Tong Fa had gone to scout the regular house to see if Parlin was all right. Denth was downstairs, fetching something. Vivenna sat on the floor. She'd changed to a long dress, purchased on the way. Her skirt was filthy from its time in the mud, and she sat with legs pulled up against her chest. Jules continued to ignore Vivenna, working atop a sheet on the floor. She was muttering to herself, still angry.
Stupid thing, Jules said under her breath. Can't believe we let you get hurt like this just to protect her.
Hurt? Did that even mean anything to a creature like Claude? He was awake. She could see that his eyes were open. What was the point of sewing up his insides? Would they heal? He didn't need to eat. Why bother with intestines?
Vivenna shivered, looking away. She felt, in a way, as if her own insides had been ripped out, exposed, for the world to see. Vivenna closed her eyes. Hours later, and she was still shaking from the terror of huddling in that alleyway, thinking that she'd be dead in a moment. What had she learned about herself when finally threatened? Modesty had meant nothing. She'd pulled off her skirt rather than let it trip her again. Her hair had meant nothing. She'd ignored it as soon as the danger arrived. Her religion, apparently, meant nothing.
Not that she'd been able to use the breath. She hadn't even managed to commit blasphemy successfully.
"I'm half tempted to just leave," Jules muttered. "You and I, go away."
Claude began to shuffle, and Vivenna opened her eyes to see him trying to stand up, even though his insides were hanging out. Jules swore.
"Lie back down," she hissed, barely audible. "Color's cursed thing. Howl of the sun. Go inactive. Howl of the sun."
Vivenna watched as Claude lay down and then stopped moving. "They might obey commands," she thought, "but they aren't very smart. It tried to walk out, obeying Jules' apparent command to go away. And what was that nonsense Jules had said about the sun? Was that one of the security phrases Denth had mentioned?" Vivenna heard footsteps on the stairs leading down to the cellar, and then the door opened, and Denth appeared. He closed the door, then came over and handed Jules something that looked like a large wineskin. The woman took it and immediately turned back to her work. Denth walked over and sat down beside Vivenna.
"They say a man doesn't know himself until he faces death for the first time," he said in a conversational tone. "I don't know about that. It seems to me that the person you are when you're about to die isn't as important as the person you are during the rest of your life. Why should a few moments matter more than an entire lifetime?"
Vivenna didn't respond.
"Everyone gets scared, princess. Even brave men sometimes run the first time they see battle. In armies, that's why there's so much training. The ones who hold aren't the courageous ones. They're the well-trained ones. We have instincts, like any other animal. They take over sometimes. That's all right."
Vivenna continued to watch as Jules carefully placed the intestines back into Claude's belly. She took out a small package and removed something that looked like a strip of meat.
"You did well, actually," Denth said. "Kept your wits about you, didn't freeze, found the quickest way out. I've protected some people who will just stand there and die unless you shake them and force them to run."
"I want you to teach me awakening,"
Vivenna whispered. He started, glancing at her. "Do you want to think about that a bit first?"
"I have," she whispered,
arms around knees, chin resting against them.
"I thought I was stronger than I am. I thought I'd rather die than use it. That was a lie. In that moment, I would have done anything to survive."
Denth smiled. "You'd make a good mercenary."
"It's wrong," she said, still staring forward. "But I can't claim to be pure anymore. I might as well understand what I have. Use it. If that damns me, then so be it. At least it will have helped me survive long enough to destroy the Halandrin."
Denth raised an eyebrow. "You want to destroy them now, eh? No more simple sabotage and undermining."
She shook her head. "I want this kingdom overthrown," she whispered. "Just like the Slumlord said. It can corrupt those poor people. It can corrupt even me. I hate it."
"I..."
"No, Denth," Vivenna said. Her hair bled to a deep red, and for once she didn't care. "I really hate it. I've always hated this people. They took my childhood. I had to prepare, become their queen, get ready to marry their god king. Everyone said he was unholy and a heretic, yet I was supposed to have sex with him. I hate this entire city, with its colors and its gods. I hate the fact that it stole away my life, then demanded that I leave behind all that I love. I hate the busy streets, the placating gardens, the commerce, and the suffocating weather. I hate their arrogance, most of all, thinking they could push my father around, force him into that treaty 20 years ago. They've controlled my life, dominated it, ruined it, and now they have my sister."
She drew in a deep breath through gritted teeth. "You'll have your vengeance, princess,"
Denth whispered. She looked at him.
I want them to hurt, Denth. The attack today wasn't about subduing a rebellious element. The Halandrin sent those soldiers in to kill. Kill the poor that they created. We're going to stop them from doing things like that. I don't care what it takes. I'm tired of being pretty and nice and ignoring ostentation. I want to do something.
Denth nodded slowly. All right. We'll change course. Start making our attacks a little more painful.
Good, she said. She squeezed her eyes shut, feeling frustrated, wishing that she was strong enough to keep all of those emotions away. But she wasn't. She'd kept them in too long. That was the problem.
This was never about your sister, was it? Denth asked. Coming here.
She shook her head, eyes still shut.
Why then?
I had trained all of my life, she whispered. I was the one who would sacrifice herself. When Ciri left in my place, I became nothing. I had to come and get it back.
But you just said that you've always hated Halandrin, he said, sounding confused.
I have, and I do. That's why I had to come.
He was silent for a few moments. Too complicated for a mercenary, I guess. She opened her eyes. She wasn't sure if she understood either. She'd always kept a firm grip on her hatred, only letting it manifest in disdain for Halandrin and its ways. She confronted the hatred now, acknowledged it. Somehow Halandrin could be loathsome, yet enticing at the same time. It was as if she knew that until she came and saw the place for herself, she wouldn't have a real focus, a real understanding, a real image of what it was that had destroyed her life. Now she understood. If her breaths would help, then she would use them. Just like Lemix. Just like those slumlords. She wasn't above that. She never had been. She doubted Denth would understand. Instead, Vivenna nodded toward Jules. What is she doing?
Denth turned. Attaching a new muscle, he said. One of the ones in his side got cut, sheared right through. Muscles won't work right if you just sew them together. She has to replace the whole thing.
With screws?
Denth nodded. Right to the bone. It works all right. Not perfectly, but all right. No wound can ever be perfectly fixed on a lifeless, though he will heal some. You just sew them up and pump them full of fresh ichor alcohol. If you fix them enough times, the body will stop working right, and you'll have to spend another breath to keep them going. By then, it's usually just best to buy another body.
Saved by a monster. Perhaps that was what made her so determined to use her breath. She should be dead, but Claude had saved her. A lifeless. She owed her life to something that shouldn't exist. Even worse, if she looked deep within herself, she found herself feeling a traitorous pity for the thing. Even an affection. Considering that, she figured that she was already damned to the point where using her breaths wouldn't matter.
He fought well, she whispered. Better than the lifeless that the city guard was using.
Denth glanced at Claude. They're not all equal. Most lifeless, they're just made out of whatever body happens to be around. If you pay good money, you can get one who was very skillful in life.
She felt a chill, remembering then that moment of humanity she'd seen on Claude's face as he defended her. If an undead monstrosity could be a hero, then a pious princess could blaspheme. Or was she still just trying to justify her actions?
Skill, she whispered. They keep it?
Denth nodded. Some semblance of it, at least. Considering what we paid for this guy, he must have been quite the soldier. And that's why it's worth the money,
time and trouble to repair him, rather than buy a new lifeless.
They treat him just like a thing, Vivenna thought, just as she should. And yet, more and more, she thought of Claude as a he. He had saved her life. Not Denth, not Tonk Fa, Claude.
It seemed to her that they should show more respect for him. Jules finished with the muscles, then sewed the skin closed with a thick string.
Though he'll kind of heal, Denth said. It's best to use something strong in the repair so the wound doesn't rip apart again.
Vivenna nodded.
And the juice?
Ichor alcohol, Denth said. Discovered by the five scholars. Wonderful stuff. Keeps a lifeless going really well.
That's what let the many war occur, she whispered. Getting the mixture right.
That's part of it. That and the discovery, again by one of the five scholars, I forget which one, of some new commands. If you really want to be an awakener, princess, that's what you have to learn. The commands.
She nodded.
Teach me.
To the side, Jules got out a small pump and attached a small hose to a little valve at the base of Claude's neck. She began to pump the ichor alcohol, moving the pump very slowly, probably in order to keep from bursting the blood vessels.
Well, Denth said, there are a lot of commands. If you want to bring a rope to life, like that one you tried to use back in the alleyway, a good command is hold things. Speak it with a clear voice, willing your breath to act. If you do it right, the rope will grab whatever is closest. Protect me is another good one, though it can be interpreted in fairly strange ways if you don't imagine exactly what you want.
Imagine? Vivenna asked.
He nodded. You have to form the command in your head, not just speak it. The breath you give up, it's part of your life. Your soul, you Idrians would say. When you awaken something, it becomes part of you. If you're good and practiced, the things you awaken will do what you expect of them. They're part of you. They understand, just like your hands understand what you want them to do.
I'll start practicing then, she said.
He nodded. You should pick it up fairly quickly. You're a clever woman, and you have a lot of breaths.
That makes a difference?
He nodded, looking somewhat distant, as if distracted by his own thoughts. The more breaths you hold when you start, the easier it is for you to learn how to awaken. It's like, I don't know, the breath is more part of you, or you're more part of it. She sat back, contemplating that.
Thank you, she finally said.
What? For explaining awakening? Half the children on the streets could have told you that much.
No, she said, though I appreciate the instruction. The thanks is for other things. For not condemning me as a hypocrite. For being willing to change plans and take risks. For protecting me today.
Last I checked, those were all the things a good employee should do. At least if that employee is a mercenary.
She shook her head. It's more than that. You're a good man, Denth.
He met her eyes, and she could see something in them. An emotion she couldn't describe. Again, she thought of the mask he wore. The persona of the laughing, joking mercenary. That man seemed just a front, when she looked into those eyes and saw so much more.
A good man, he said, turning away. Sometimes I wish that were still true, princess. I haven't been a good man for some years now.
She opened her mouth to reply, but something made her hesitate. Outside, a shadow passed the window. Tong Fa entered a few moments later. Denth stood up without glancing at her.
Well? He asked Tong Fa.
Looks safe, Tongfa said, eyeing Claude. How's the stiff?
Just finished, Jules said.